This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Mayor Jenny Durkan signed Seattle's new head tax into law yesterday. No big signing ceremony at City Hall. The tax on the city's largest businesses would pay for housing and homeless services. Now there are rumblings of an effort or efforts to mount a referendum to repeal this tax. KUOW reporter Amy Radel is here to tell you about it. Hi, Amy.
Hi, good morning.
What are the odds that it's Seattle voters who are going to be next weighing in on this just passed head tax?
It's really early, obviously. It was just signed yesterday, but we're hearing that there are maybe even multiple efforts afoot or multiple groups considering mounting some kind of a referendum to let voters weigh in on the tax. We could see filings at the city clerk's office even tomorrow. One of the people who's backing this effort is named Saul Spady. He's the grandson of the founder of the Dick's Drive-In Company. And he says that the city council has gone rogue in passing this head tax, and that even though they passed it unanimously and it was billed as a compromise, many businesses strongly oppose the tax. They don't feel like they were represented in that compromise. They think it's a misguided effort that could result in lost jobs, and he thinks it's unpopular with voters too. So he wants to seek a referendum to let voters weigh in on it.
How would that referendum come about?
So we always have to relearn this process every time it surfaces, partly because the number of signatures needed does change. It's based on how many people voted in the last mayor's election. So to seek a referendum, the petition gatherers need to get 17,632 signatures, and they need to file those within the next 30 days. So it's a very tight time frame. But Spady says he then wants to work with other business groups, not only on the referendum idea, but he says the next step would be an initiative to look at how the city could collaborate with other entities to address homelessness.
The next big step is probably reaching out to some of the bigger businesses, and I'm sure they're also thinking about this as well. But I definitely believe that going forward, homelessness needs to be solved by a coalition of businesses, community members, and hopefully when the council is in a space to work with us, the council.
Yes, I've interviewed Saul Spady, and listeners can go to our website and find a conversation about his vision of businesses. We're tweeting that out. We're tweeting out a link to it right now. Thank you, social media producer Bree Ripley. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Yes, his vision for businesses taking their own part without a head tax. So, Amy Radel, there's a lot that would have to happen. What would happen if voters agreed with Saul Spady and repealed the city's head tax?
Well, Seattle is running a deficit right now, so it's not even to say that, oh, we only wouldn't do these new things that we imagine doing with the head tax. That might actually be part of continuing existing services from the city. So if it were repealed, there would be some very tough choices. And then the other moving parts are businesses are pressing for some kind of credit for maybe charitable contributions that they make. And in fact, Saul's sister is the vice president of Dick's, and she was part of an op-ed proposing options like that, some kind of incentive program. And then there's this one table effort where the city is saying it's going to work more closely with the county and the region. So maybe that's where we would start to look for some funding answers to basically at least continue what the city's doing and then look at what it's going to do in addition to help people facing homelessness.
KUOW's Amy Radel is following effort or efforts to mount a referendum to repeal Seattle's new employee head tax. KUOW's Amy Radel, thanks for telling us about it.
Yeah, thanks.
How should the city spend whatever money it has to alleviate homelessness in this town? We're going to get into that in just a moment on The Record. One of the big questions people are asking in this conversation about homelessness and affordability is, can we trust the city to spend its money effectively? A new report from Seattle University's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project says Seattle is not spending on the right things. And I have the director of Seattle University's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project here with me now, Professor Sarah Rankin. Welcome.
Thank you.
One of your main arguments is that we should focus on lowering the barrier to get people into housing. Will you tell us what is low barrier housing?
Low barrier housing, and it's important to put the emphasis both on low barrier and housing. We're not talking about low barrier shelters.
Yes. What's the difference?
The difference is that low barrier, especially what you would see in something called Housing First programs, don't require people to accept services or treatment or any other precondition to having access to permanent supportive housing.
What are those preconditions typically?
Typically, we would require people to fix themselves of whatever substance addiction they may have, for them to get on top of mental illness, for them to fix other signs, common signs of trauma that exist in populations experiencing homelessness. It's an unrealistic expectation.
So a low barrier housing is an apartment, a single occupancy? This is partners, friends, children? Who's there?
There's many different models across the country. As I mentioned, if your listeners are interested, they can Google housing first and they'll see the diversity of approaches that are being taken across the country. So they can be apartments, they can be communal living. But the key key thread that runs through all of them is that they don't have preconditions to participation. And this is not just kumbaya feeling good approach. We know from science and from studies, extensive, rigorous analysis of housing first approaches, that it is the most effective way of dealing with chronic homelessness, and it results in huge savings to taxpayers.
And we'll talk about why that would be. And is this a rent-free apartment, a sliding scale? Can someone live there forever?
Again, it depends on the program. Some programs, once you get a job, will ask you to contribute some percentage of your income. Some programs operate for a number of months. Some programs have no length of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it really varies. And that's what makes it so successful, is it's a very flexible model.
You mentioned that residents don't have to kick an addiction. Is there alcohol use allowed in those in the housing? And what about illegal drugs?
There's no conditions at all.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you can drink there. Again, the rules, the very specific rules, will vary about what people can be doing. But what we've seen, what's so important about this, is that what we've seen is, by providing people the stability of housing first and not requiring them to accept services or treatment as a precondition to receiving that housing, that eventually, once people get that stability, they pursue the treatment and services at a higher rate, and they rates of recidivism are much lower than we would see if they weren't experiencing the stability of housing.
And we have some low barrier housing examples in Seattle.
Yes.
So why aren't there more on the scale that you'd like to see low barrier housing in Seattle?
Well, you can talk to Daniel Malone at the DESC and Paul Ambrose.
Downtown Emergency Services.
Yes, and Plymouth Housing are two excellent examples, very different approaches to the way that they implement the housing first model. But they need more money, they need more facilities, they need more space. And the key to that is not just revenue, but also community support for the siting of those facilities.
Yes, community support for the siting. That's a little jargony sounding. What it can mean is, who wants to be next to low barrier housing? People who live there have said they are magnets for crime. So let's start there. What do you say to that?
The studies that I've seen show that there is no significant I'm trying to use easy language. I was going to say correlation. There's no significant correlation between housing first or other authorized, housing facilities for people who are experiencing chronic homelessness associated with those in the surrounding communities.
One shelter manager, Frank Morrison, said about this, about the low barrier approach: most humans will try to take the easier path. If we crack the door becomes wide open for some people, and they'll just use the system. What about that idea that people who, for example, are addicted or are just, making poor decisions, they've got to hit rock bottom instead of being enabled?
So housing first totally rebuts the enabling, narrative that you're talking about. Again, people who take part in Housing First programs not only have a higher rate of eventually accepting treatment and services, but when they do that on their own time, the way that they stick with the treatment and services and the overall impact that it has on their health and their social outcomes is much more resilient than if we don't.
And why is that?
It's because people have to be ready. You know, you can't force someone to be able to focus on a secondary trauma. Those things that we're talking about are really secondary traumas to the primary traumas that they're experiencing by virtue of living on the street.
What are primary traumas?
But living on the street, having no privacy, having no safety, having no security. Living on the street in and of itself is an extraordinary trauma. So that's one of the reasons why it's so important to prevent people from becoming homeless in the first place, is there's a lot of science that shows the second that you are living on the street, the chances of your trauma manifesting itself as mental illness, manifesting itself as turning to self-medication, or manifesting itself as being pulled through the jail system skyrocket. So we really want to keep people off the street to begin with.
Well, then what about the cheaper alternative of authorized encampments, where you could say it's on the street in a way, but it's different because it's some kind of temporary shelter. It's people in community. It's people not being kicked out, you know, and displaced.
Right. So, you know, the ultimate solution, there's sort of fights among folks who work on homeless rights advocacy about whether we ever want to focus on interim solutions. The ultimate solution, the priority, is really affordable housing and housing first, bringing those models to scale so that people have a permanent, stable place to be. Now, I'm a pragmatist. So I think we can have conversations about ultimate solutions and at the same time know, especially in a place like Seattle where we like to argue things to death at the expense of actually doing anything. I like to talk also about interim solutions, and authorized encampments are a proven successful way of doing that. Even the city's own evaluations of the authorized encampments suggest that they have a higher rate of placing people in permanent housing than even at the time that I saw the evaluation, even than the navigation center or other forms of intervention. So they can be extremely effective interim solutions. And one of our reports dives deep into authorized encampments.
Okay. Again, we're talking with Professor Sarah Rankin. She's a law professor at Seattle University. She's also the director of the university's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. And we're talking about solutions. And, of course, there are more than one approach to Seattle's homelessness crisis. So what's your vision? So if the city did, and you make a number of recommendations. We just talked about authorized encampments. We talked about low-barrier housing. Are you saying that if the city spent its money the way you would like, that so many people would leave the streets for these low-barrier homes that tents would, disappear from bridges and parks and sidewalks? People wouldn't be sleeping in alleys and benches? What's your vision in Seattle?
I do think that we can solve the homelessness crisis by providing housing for people. It's not just me. It's not just what I would want. It's essentially what anyone who spends a lot of time looking at what the studies say would want. So my vision would be increasing our investments in affordable housing, just like the McKinsey report recommends. In fact, the McKinsey Institute has recommendations for what cities can do to improve investments and to increase affordable housing, but also to invest more heavily in Housing First programs. DESC, which we just talked about, and Plymouth Housing are underfunded and need more space. So if we could bring Housing First to scale and we invested adequately in affordable housing, I do think you would see a visible difference in our chronic homeless population.
You know, it might sound as if we're talking about people being just moved around, as if they don't have autonomy. What about people who they don't want to deal with an apartment and a landlord?
I have yet to meet anyone who is suffering from homelessness and the trauma of daily existence on the street who says, you know what I don't want to deal with is a landlord. If people are given a meaningful offer of permanent supportive housing, the vast majority of people will accept that offer. The difference is the way that we go about things now is we require services or treatment. We tell someone, you know what I can give you? I can give you outreach. I can require you to accept services or treatment.
I can give you a referral.
And actually, a lot of times, even those referrals turn out to be smoke and mirrors, because we'll find out that the person that has been recommended that referral is ineligible for that service or shelter, or they can't get to that service or shelter. And so what people experiencing homelessness often learn through experience is that offers of services and shelter are false, that they're non-existent. And so then you get this sort of learned apathy, where even when a real offer of meaningful service or shelter comes along, people have already reasonably and logically through experience learned not to accept it. But if people understood that there was a meaningful offer of supportive housing that didn't require them.
What does supportive mean?
Supportive housing is an example of housing first. It's sort of a term of art that means that housing has some wraparound services that are available for people who want to avail themselves.
Like what?
Mental health services, drug addiction treatment, job services, job placement services, educational supports, all sorts of supports that really...
So someone knocks on your door and says, hey, we want to help, here's places you can go, but it's not a barrier, it's not a requirement, it's not a barrier to entry.
I got caught up on the knocking on the door.
I'm just wondering how when we say wraparound service, how what's the interaction like with the person who we want to come off the street? And then what? Then what happens? Because some people say, okay, so you've moved them into an apartment where they're unsupervised. That's the imagination of some people who don't understand. I read to you the comment from the shelter manager saying people will just take the easy way.
Mm-hmm.
What does life become like for that person who's now in this home?
Well, you're not just left to your own devices and no one ever talks to you again. You know, the notion is that you want to be able to build a supportive community that doesn't require people to do stuff, but makes it very clear to the residents that there are those services available when they're ready. And so it's not unlike in some ways that a lot of your listeners have probably taken elders to assisted living facilities. In the ideal world, a lot of the Housing First programs are something like that, where people aren't just left to sort of fester in their rooms by themselves, but at the same time,
there's a common room, and right
there can be all sorts of ways that they build community and support into the actual infrastructure of the facility.
When Starbucks came out against the new head tax on business, the senior vice president John Kelly accused Seattle of ignoring the plight of children sleeping outside. He said, quote, if the city cannot provide a warm meal and safe bed to a 5-year-old child, no one believes they'll be able to make housing affordable or address opiate addiction. Do you agree that Seattle should get all children into housing before childless adults?
I don't think we need to prioritize at all. I think the goal here should really be getting everyone off of the street. I certainly believe that we have a serious crisis with respect to homeless youth. But with all due respect to Starbucks, you know, that sort of response to the head tax is a bit of a bait and switch. It's trying to play on people's emotions, thinking about children. But it's the same thing that happens in a lot of discussions about homelessness, where you'll see it go the other way, playing on fear. People worrying about, there was a recent coverage of someone who was unfortunately raped, and the coverage really stressed the fact that this guy was homeless.
Yeah, but like, separate from the fear, though, the Starbucks executive's point, I think, is that there's not unlimited money. The city has to prioritize. So you should. You should prioritize people, young people who didn't make these choices, don't have a say in the matter, and can be traumatized for, you know, decades to come by things that happen to them because they're homeless children. And that is worthy of priority.
That's absolutely true. Children had no choice, and neither do survivors of domestic violence, who are the leading, sort of representatives of homeless women. Neither do veterans who come back with PTSD and, a lack of social network. So when we get into a battle about who's the most worthy, it plays sort of on our worst instincts, thinking about the only way that we want to be able to talk about housing is to focus on who's worthy. And something we haven't covered yet, which is so important for your listeners to understand, because some people will not be persuaded by the notion that housing is a human right and that we can actually make an enormous difference in the lives of people who are suffering. So if that doesn't persuade you, you have to be persuaded by the exhaustive research that shows that it costs taxpayers less to house people who are experiencing homelessness than it does to leave them where they are. And that's because we know that if you leave people where they are, the Housing First studies all show that Housing First, housing people who are chronically homeless, regardless of whether we deem them worthy, saves money because it stops people from being churned through emergency services, emergency shelters, and the criminal justice system. Those are the by far the most expensive and least effective ways of addressing homelessness, but it has for too long been our priority in Seattle to take that approach.
We'll keep having this conversation. We invite people who are listening to you now and have other points of view. This is an ongoing discussion. Our email address, record@kuow.org, and we're on Twitter @KUOW, and I'd like to talk to you again, too, and follow this along, Professor.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Rankin, Professor of Law, Seattle University, Director of the Seattle University Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Stay tuned for more of The Record, the almost impossible mission to Pluto that worked. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Do you remember when Pluto was declared not a planet? It was 2006. The man who helped kick Pluto out of the Planet Club, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, received hate mail.
Hate mail from third graders because of this. Third grade. Piss a crayon scrawled. Wait. Dear Dr. Tyson, put Pluto back in. Here's what it looks like. And... my favorite, it says, and write back soon, but not in cursive. I don't know how to read cursive yet.
We care. We care deeply about this far, far away icy rock. And few people care more than my next guests. Planetary scientist Alan Stern and astrobiologist David Grinspoon were part of a mission to send a spacecraft to Pluto to explore what had never been explored before. Some people thought they were nuts. They're here to tell us why they went to Pluto and what they found. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Hey, great to be here.
Thanks a lot.
You just heard how angry people were about Pluto being demoted, kids and grown-ups. Will you remind us why, briefly, why Pluto got kicked out of the Planet Club?
Well, frankly, it was BS. That's what I call bad science.
I see. What was the reason, for
you know,
those who don't
it
remember?
It was people like Neil, who are not experts in planetary science, but astronomers in a different field, who were afraid that school children would have to memorize the names of too many planets. I don't know how to get sillier with science than that.
You know, yeah, if you were a third grader, you would have written to Neil in crayon saying
in this
BS.
Case, the third graders were actually right. As planetary scientists, we never stopped calling Pluto a planet. If you're concerned with the properties of what a planet is, then a place like Pluto is sort of obviously a planet to planetary scientists. That astronomer's definition had to do with what was orbiting around it, and they sort of contrived it to keep the number of planets small. So the press reported it as a done deal, as the voice of authority, but the people who study planets kind of ignored it, and we still call Pluto a planet.
I guess officially, according to that body, it's a dwarf planet. So for one thing, I think people responded because Pluto felt like an underdog, you know, like who hasn't felt small and cold and isolated and kicked out of a club, right?
Absolutely. People actually seem to really identify with Pluto.
Yes.
It's one thing that we keep discovering, and we talk about this in our book, Chasing New Horizons, that the public support for a Pluto mission at times was really pivotal in helping Alan and his team rescue this mission when it was threatened many times. Tens of thousands of letters showing up at NASA saying, no, we want a mission to Pluto. And the public reaction when New Horizons finally got to Pluto was overwhelming. People love this planet.
Yes. Alan, I understand us going to the moon. I understand us seeing if we can live on Mars. But why did you want to go to Pluto?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. One was the science was just mouthwatering. It really represented a brand new class of planets that started popping up in the 1990s. Now there are more than a dozen of them known that are like Pluto, very far out there. And secondly, the exploration value is very high. We had explored all the planets out to Neptune, and exploring Pluto allowed us, the United States, to complete what we started in the 1960s, which is what Carl Sagan called the initial reconnaissance of our solar system. It was a little bit of unfinished business, a little bit of a dare. And we built and flew a spacecraft out there and made the first exploration of it, the New Horizons team. And that's what Chasing New Horizons is about, that project.
Yes, a dare. I mean, can you describe how hard it is to send a probe to Pluto?
Well, it was hard for a lot of reasons. For one thing, it's very far away, 3 billion miles. And we were the fastest spacecraft ever launched, covering almost 1 million miles a day. And it still took 9.5 years for this lone Sentinel to travel across all that distance. And we couldn't afford for it to break. We couldn't afford for it to make any mistakes. And it's one shot flyby of that little planet.
You've got to figure out where Pluto's going to be in 9 years and get exactly that spot.
Yeah, in fact, we had to arrive within a little box about 40 by 60 miles after traveling for 3 billion, and we had to arrive within 9 minutes of the prescribed time, or the pictures wouldn't have turned out well.
Why was it that precise?
Because that's what it takes in order to do the experiments that we wanted to do. We had to fly through Pluto's shadow to study the planet's atmosphere. We had to arrive at just the known time so that we could make sure that the camera is correctly pointed at the planet and all of its satellites.
And you have to have the flash on, or else the whole thing is a waste. Yeah.
And it was a big flash.
Sure. you're nodding your head, David.
Yeah, I mean, the navigation challenges alone were tremendous. Alan just told you the numbers, and the analogy someone worked out that is a true calculation is that it's the equivalent of hitting a golf ball from Los Angeles to New York and hitting a hole in one the first try. It's that precise.
How close did it get to failure?
You know, there were many times that this mission should not have succeeded. If you go through the whole story, you're left with an impression that it seems like incredibly miraculous that it did succeed. There were so many different threats that were overcome, many of which were before it ever launched.
There were political threats. There were technical challenges.
Why political threats?
Well, because there's a lot of competition for funding within NASA. NASA has a fixed budget. There are lots of good ideas.
Oh, the politics of money.
Exactly.
And then there was one intense crisis that occurred right at the last minute in terms of the journey to Pluto. On Pluto's doorstep, after traveling for 9.5 years, mostly without incident, from Earth past Jupiter onto Pluto, 10 days out from Pluto, something horrible went wrong and the spacecraft went offline. And for a while, they didn't know if they would ever hear from it again. They're barreling in on Pluto. They're going to pass it one way or another in a few days, and it may not be working. Then they get contact back with the spacecraft, and it turns out that it's messed up. All the files are gone that they need for the flyby. And this kicked in this incredible, heroic, round-the-clock team effort to rescue the mission just in the nick of time. It was really incredible.
Incredible now. What was it like then?
Well, our team knew that the chips were down and we really had to perform. And in fact, people came streaming in. It was a holiday. It was the 4th of July. And they ended up staying for the entire 3 days until we got it fixed. It was really quite a team effort. And that's how the book starts off, is with that existential threat to the flyby of Pluto. It's a thriller.
Again, the book is called Chasing New Horizons. New Horizons is the name of the space probe that flew past Pluto and took some photographs. We're talking with Dr. Alan Stern, engineer and planetary scientist, principal investigator of that mission, and Dr. David Grinspoon, U.S. Library of Congress chair of astrobiology. So 3 years ago, the New Horizons probe did it, got close enough to Pluto to photograph it, and what was the most important thing we learned from that?
We learned that small planets like Pluto, just about the size of the United States, like a continent instead of the size of the Earth, could be just as complex and just as active as their larger brethren like Earth and Mars. And that was
not
expected.
How is it complex and active?
Well, take a look at the pictures and you'll see Pluto has flowing glaciers, frozen lakes, a water ice ocean on its interior, 5 moons, a complex active atmosphere, volcanoes the size of Mauna Loa, and I could go on.
And none of this was expected. You know, the sort of textbook view we had before New Horizons got to Pluto was that small planets like that, so far from the sun, would be kind of dead and inactive and just covered with craters.
Like our moon.
Like our moon.
A rock.
And instead,
it's
alive, it's flowing, it's vibrant, and there's all kinds of activity that now we have to go back to the drawing board and come up with new theories to understand.
In fact, I remember the heart-shaped patch when those photos came out. That was ice, basically, glaciers?
It's a glacier the size of Texas and Oklahoma combined, made of nitrogen ice. And it was basically born yesterday. We can't find any craters on it, which means that it's very young. It hasn't been out there very long.
How can such a cold planet that I always thought was just going to be practically absolute zero, how can so much be happening on it?
Because there's an engine on the inside that's operating all of that geology. And that's what David said. We don't understand how that is, but in fact, that's what nature does. And we have to figure it out now.
It's made of these familiar materials in really exotic conditions. So here on Earth, we have nitrogen. That's what we're breathing mostly in the atmosphere. On Pluto, the nitrogen is frozen out on the surface as a giant glacier. And we didn't really understand the properties of a giant nitrogen glacier on that scale at those temperatures until we got there and saw it behaving. And now the physicists are having a field day going back and saying, okay, let's figure out why this is behaving the way it is.
Does a planet's size have anything to do with how active it is? You talked about it being the size of a continent.
Yeah, we used to think that smaller worlds would be simpler.
Uh-huh.
Pluto completely defied that expectation. It has all the complexity of Earth or Mars.
By the way, how, just so I can imagine it, I'm picturing the Little Prince, if you ever saw the like the little boy on the tiny planet. If I were living on Pluto, how often would I see a sunrise?
Every 6.5 days.
6.5 days. A sunrise. Oh, wait. So I would. Okay. That's because it's so far from.
No, it's just because it turns slowly on its axis.
Oh, it turns slowly. Okay. Yeah.
But you would also, if you were on the right part of Pluto, you would see a giant moon in the sky. This moon, Charon, which would be beautiful, huge, looming in the sky. But the funny thing is you'd have to be on the right part of Pluto to see it because it orbits with Pluto's rotation. So if you're on the wrong side, you'd never see that giant moon. If you're on the right side, you'd always see it.
It just hangs stationary over that side of the planet.
The stealthiest moon. So does the fact that Pluto has, did you say multiple moons?
It has five.
Is that part of the case you make for Pluto being a planet?
Well, its planethood has to do with what Pluto is, not what it's surrounded by.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you saw Pluto show up on the viewfinder of the Starship Enterprise on an episode, you would identify that as there must be yet a planet. It's not a star, it's not an asteroid, it's not a galaxy or an alien spaceship.
Did your photos add to the case for Pluto being a... Are we talking about whether it's a planet or a dwarf planet?
Well, dwarf planets are a type of planet.
Yeah.
No, the sun is a dwarf star. It doesn't make it not a star.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, part of what...
Well, what's at stake here? It's just we're not going to bother teaching it to kids because there's lots of dwarf planets just as big as Pluto, and that's so there has to be a cutoff?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually very little at stake. The whole thing was kind of misguided, and, you know, what's really important is that there's all these worlds out there that are amazing. Not what you call them, but the fact is a dwarf planet is a perfectly respectable term for this small kind of planet. And if they had just said that, the astronomers would have been fine. But they added this sort of nonsensical coda to their definition, which said a dwarf planet is not a planet.
But, you know, the other thing that's important is that the United States showed it's on its game. It explored a place 3 billion miles away. No other nation on Earth, no other space program on Earth can touch that kind of feat. We did it in one try, and we did it perfectly.
That was launched... How many years ago, though? What does it say about the U.S. and space exploration now?
It was launched in 2006, arrived in 2015, and it shows that NASA's on its game. So is the United States.
And by the way, New Horizons is still going and still operating, and there's going to be another encounter with an unknown world this coming New Year's Eve. This small object called Ultima Thule that we don't even really know very much about other than that it's small and it's by far the farthest thing we will have ever explored.
But what's so important about that? Because the Kuiper Belt lies beyond, what, Neptune, is it? And so there's a bunch of little objects out there. What's so important about Ultima Thule?
Well, it's a representative of this whole zone of the solar system that we've barely explored. Before Pluto, we had never been anywhere in the Kuiper Belt. And we've explored one object and its moons out there, one planet. But there's trillions of objects in the Kuiper Belt. And the small ones are leftover building blocks from making planets. It's sort of like it's the attic of the solar system. It's the leftover pieces. And we've never been to one of those. And this is the stuff that the planets were made out of. So I think we stand to learn, you know, not just about exploring this cool new place, type of place that we've never been to, but potentially some important stories about how the planets all formed and how the solar system got to be the way it is.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because I'll ask you the annoying question, which is, so what? You know, so we learn stuff, and what would we, is it just, well, you know, discovery is amazing, and it's the human spirit, or is it that and we're going to learn vital information that's going to save humanity from doom?
It is about the heart and the head. It is about understanding our universe and our origins, but it's also about this nation's soft power projection. And it's frankly about inspiring children to STEM careers. This entire economy, Seattle knows that better than anywhere, is powered by engineers and scientists. And space exploration inspires kids to go into those very hard fields like electrical engineering, like computer science, like physics, more than any other. That's a documented fact. And we received so many letters, so many tweets, so many other kinds of contacts from parents and children alike when we explored Pluto, saying, that's what I want to grow up and do. That turned my kid on. That turned their grades around. They were inspired by that. Now, what could be better than that, honestly?
And by the way, it's also going to help us save the world. Because without a space program, we'd be sunk. We've got challenges like climate change, and the planet is changing. Without Earth observations, without space platforms, and without comparative planetology to understand how Earth works by looking elsewhere, we would be flying blind on this planet. So I think there is a pragmatic sense in which we need to understand how planets work, and this kind of exploration helps us do it.
Doctors David Grinspoon and Alan Stern, they're speaking tonight at the Museum of Flight, south of Seattle, tonight, 7:30, and their book is Chasing New Horizons. What a pleasure. Thank you to both of you.
Thanks
great
a lot.
Being here.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back.
To melt your icy blue hole. Should I stop?
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. The Seattle International Film Festival begins today. Among the many, many offerings is a short film called Always. Angela DeMarco is the Seattle-based writer and director of the film.
I never wanted it to be a film that is just about losing a child during pregnancy.
The film Always is DeMarco's directorial debut. In it, she follows a couple grieving over their loss, and it is partially based on her own story. When she joined us in the studio, she told us about losing her own son, Caleb, during pregnancy and why she dedicated the film to him.
This was the third child that my husband, Dave, and I had lost. And Caleb was the furthest along. So we were out of the quote-unquote danger zone. You know, don't say anything until after 3 months. And after losing two, I kind of realized, like, oh, I guess that's probably why. But just to rewind a little bit before Caleb, after we lost our second, I asked my husband if I could go public. We have kind of a following on social media. We have our own acting studio, our own production company. And when I went public with our second loss, the hundreds of women and men that commented and posted who had also been through that experience. And it shocked me that there were so many and so many who had lost children well past that 3-month mark. So now to Caleb, we were past 3 months, you know, we were past two ultrasounds. We literally saw him that Friday, and I knew something was wrong. I felt different. There was a lot of things going on with my body that I knew didn't feel right. And we called the hotline, and this is in December, December 30th. And the nurse hotline, you know, it's holidays. It's right after Christmas. It's right before New Year's. So you don't get your OBGYN. And the poor nurse said, oh, it's just round ligament pain. Chalked it up to that. So what do? You go on internet, you look at that. Seemed right, I guess. And I went into early labor soon after.
And in Caleb's case, you had told friends, loved ones.
Yes.
Everyone knew that you were pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So this time, what was it like as being part of a community now to mm-hmm. lose Caleb?
Another thing I had done between our second and Caleb was I started a support group called Chow Bela. Ciao, which some people know is Italian. It means hello, but it also means goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
So for that, that was something I think I needed, because I needed people I could talk to that when they said, I can imagine or I understand, that I really could look at them and know, you actually do.
Do you wish we had more of a culture of women talking more early on about their pregnancies?
Yes.
And about miscarriages?
Yes, 100%, Bill. It's one of the nurses who helped me in the emergency room after we gave birth to Caleb at home, and it was my husband and my mom. I called my mom, and she lives across the water. Instead of hopping on a ferry, she drove all the way around, was speeding on I-5, and a cop even pulled her over, and she just broke down crying and said, my daughter is losing her son. And he said, let's get you there. So she rushes in the door, and I'll tell you, it was something that I wish, if women had been already talking about it, I would have been more prepared. If our medical team had been more willing to talk about it, I would have been more prepared. I had already gone through two, and what I was told was, oh, it's normal.
Why do you think we don't talk more about it or differently about miscarriage?
I really think it's because it is really common. So I could see where, and again, this is not me bashing the medical system. This is me just talking about my own experience. But from my own experience, when we lost our first, and all I was told was, well, it happens. Literally, that was the words out of my OBGYN's mouth. Okay, well, it's never happened to me.
That OBGYN probably thought they were being comforting by saying...
Maybe. I would think. Maybe. Yes, actually, yeah. Yes, I would say yes. I would assume that's like, oh, to have comfort in that, hey, this happens. And it's to try again is totally healthy and great. So back to you saying building this community. I loved that I had this community. And me saying I want to start a conversation where we can openly more talk about it is because I think, yes, it is common. But that nurse in the emergency room when I lost Caleb, after we decided to go, she was not from here. I mean, she's here now, but she was from Kenya. And she was saying in her small village, when women get pregnant, you celebrate as soon as you know. And it's almost as though a village, you know, you need a village to raise a child. Yeah, I'm Italian. You know, I have this huge Italian family. Trust me, we are a village. So doesn't it make sense to talk about as soon as you get pregnant so you can start making your village for when you do bring that baby into the world, hopefully, or if you have to say goodbye and let that baby go?
And why do you think women tend to keep their pregnancy to themselves?
It's what we're told.
Up to about, you know, what, 3-month mark or whatever it is.
I mean, I can only speak for me. So for me, it is what was instilled in me since, you know, you took, you know, when you're in school. And they say, you know, that's because that's a lot of times when the problems do occur. But I would like to say this, after starting my support group, the stories of the people that contacted us, I would say well over 50%, if not more, lost their children way past that mark. I'm talking 8 months, 7 months, or they give birth and then there's SIDS. Or they give birth and then there's something happens. Because that's also where Always came about, is Always is not a film about miscarriage. And I also don't use that word anymore. And I only used it now because I know that's what people recognize, is when you lose a baby and you can't go full term. I don't think it's fair that we call it this miss something, this mishap. Because I think that really undermines myself as a mother.
Sounds like mistake.
Yes.
Like a misstep.
Yes. And it's your carriage, how it missed.
Hmm.
So then it also seems like it's also my fault. Which, trust me, we already feel like it's our fault enough. I mean, I'm a year going on 6 months, and I still have days where, you know, right now I'm welling up. It's, you know, why? Because they still can't tell me.
I'm talking with Angela DeMarco, a filmmaker whose movie Always is a short film premiering at Seattle International Film Festival. And in this film, Angela, you play a mother named Marie,
mm-hmm.
who has lost a child, and Marie imagines seeing her child again. Mm. But that child is a, what, 6-7-year-old girl?
Mm.
I assumed that the child in the story had died at that age.
Mm.
The word miscarriage, or maybe pregnancy loss is a better word, is not mentioned. Why did you decide to make the film that way?
So with Always, my intent when I wrote it, first of all, I was in a rabbit hole of my own depression. I literally, it just came to me and I started writing and I really didn't know what it was until I had it. And then I asked my husband, are you comfortable with us doing this? Because it was about a man and a woman who lost a child. Now, yes, I made it a daughter. Now, without getting into it too much, I do believe our second child was a girl. So I will say that. Now, I was not as far along with our second as I was with Caleb. But from the support groups that I created, from my own research and books I've read, depending what your beliefs are, I have heard stories of people in general who have lost a loved one, but especially with children. If they have lost an infant, that sometimes the powers that be, whether you believe in God, which I do, but others, you may just think the powers that be or spirits, whatever it is you want to believe, that they will come to you. But a lot of times nobody wants to have an infant come to them because that's a little bit creepy. Those of you who've seen the movie Trainspotting, you know, I think of that movie. You don't want like an infant crawling on the ceiling,
yeah,
right? And you can't talk with an infant. Not a conversation. So a lot of times people talk about how their child came to them in the age of like a 6-, 7-, or 8-year-old and how they saw them and they talked to them. So when I wrote the script, I knew that's what this is. My intent was this woman lost this child in pregnancy. Yet, I wanted the story to be ambiguous enough so that anyone who has lost a child can watch this story about the aftermath, the grief and aftermath that happens after losing a child.
And is there a message you wanted to send? That's always a tricky question,
yeah,
for an artist, that you're saying, think of your child as an angel, or that you're just saying you're not alone, or what do you want your viewer to get from your film?
For sure that you're not alone. I think I've never felt more alone in my life than I did last year. And I think it's easy for us to get lost, lose faith, lose hope, because not everyone has a great partner. Sometimes these losses break couples apart.
Both you and your husband star in the film, and you show a bit of how both people grieve.
Mm.
How was that different for you and your husband?
Wow. So, oh, now I'll get emotional. The partner, I think it is so important because I think their journey is almost harder. Because if you think about it, that partner has to be there for the mother, has to care for us. We're the ones, possibly, if it is a case in losing your child during pregnancy, during that loss, they can't understand. So they may not get to fully grieve. I really do think my husband took so much care of me last year that he probably didn't get to fully grieve his own son. And that makes me, I feel awful about that. I'm like, I'll give you this year. No, it's, I mean, I joke about it, but it is something that we need to make light of these situations and find the joy that, wow, we had this child together, but that we did lose the same child together.
Angela, you originally made this film, just told this story for yourself.
Yes.
Said, so why share it with the public in the form of this short film?
When I decided I actually wanted to make it, first I just showed it to David. I said, this is something I'm doing to deal with my grief, is to get it on paper. So I asked him, I said, would you be willing to do this with me? And I said, you know, I'll direct it, I'll produce it, I'll bring a really small crew together, and there's only 3 actors, and they were all friends. I found out that almost all of us had, without knowing, this is not why I asked them. I asked them first because they're people I loved working with. They were people that I trusted, that I knew could handle if I had to cry every 10 minutes or David would cry, or, you know, that it was going to be a long weekend. I found out that all of them had lost a child personally or had in their family.
You know, many of us know somebody who has lost a child. Do you have any advice on what to say?
For me, what I didn't want to hear was, oh, just keep trying, keep trying. For me, the last thing I wanted someone to assume or tell me was that A, I should try again, and B, that it would, you know, that one would stick, or that one would, you know, be right, or that one, like the others weren't. As of right now, we are not trying. You know, I am past a woman of a certain age. I'm 40 years old. It was already 3 years of us trying that I was like, uh-oh, I'm a grandma. I mean, I know that's not too old nowadays, but still. I also think the reason why I think it could be good, and everyone is different, but for me, it was good to go public because then I didn't have to repeat the same story every single time I saw someone. So I really think just be a friend, be there to really listen, and don't think we need more advice because we probably just got a whole ton of it from our medical team up until the point of losing our children.
Angela DeMarco, again, the film is Always, and it's premiering at the Seattle International Film Festival. Thank you for writing it down, and then thank you for making the film and coming in and sharing it with us.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Always will premiere on Memorial Day, Monday, May 28th, at Seattle International Film Festival. You'll find more information about the film and tickets at our website, KUOW.org. That's our show, The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jima Brempong, Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. And tomorrow, it's the Week in Review. We'll tell you what happened this week and what it all means. Hope to talk to you then.